thinking of seeing this.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious.
Horse riders, the Kelly girls, his sisters.
Were they?
They rode everywhere.
Yeah, well, everyone did.
All right, boys, we're on. Now, the man that you're talking to off while I'm trying to introduce these people, get your mouth back from the microphone. You're going to chip your teeth, Don. The man that I'm about to introduce, I've had many conversations with this man. We have robust and good conversations. I don't think there's almost a topic that we agree on, whether it be sport, social life, politics. But I tell you what, I enjoy speaking to him because he's...
You just interrupted an interesting conversation I had with him, and we were talking about the merits of the Kelly girls, the sisters of Ned Kelly, and how he said they were very good horsewomen.
Well, before I introduce you, please, okay. This is what happens. What you were speaking to our guest off air has got... Don, I'm trying to introduce who... we're speaking to. You can bring all that up when we start, but it's no good having a chat about him if I haven't introduced him, right? And I've been wanting to speak to him for a while, but there's one topic that got him in here, and that was, I think, inspired him to come in as a result of someone we interviewed a couple of weeks ago, a man called Nick Stevens. So this got him across the line to come in here, and we had a very sensible and affable and pleasant chat about that, as we have all our conversations, and none of them we ever agree on. But that's the beauty of communication, Don. Now, I'm going to tell you who he is, if you haven't worked out by the snatch of his voice that you just got then. He is an Aussie rules legend, high-profile Aussie rules player in a competition that almost rivaled the VFL in its day, the VFA. That's where he cut his teeth. He made his VFA debut for Coburg in 1975. He was the premiership captain coach. He played in a premiership in 1979. He's going to correct me if any of this is wrong. And he was the captain coach of back-to-back premiers of 84. He was the captain coach of Coburg from 84 to 87, and he coached the premiership sides in 88 and 89 back-to-back. In the 1986 grand final against Williamstown, he got ordered off. Got ordered off, Don.
Why?
Don, this is why we're not going to try and guess why he got ordered off. We're going to ask him. I'm introducing him. He took the federal seat of Wills off. He didn't take it off Bob Hawke. Bob Hawke retired.
I remember that.
It stepped out or whatever. And he became elected the member of Wills in 1992 as an independent.
And I admire him for standing as an independent.
He then got voted out due to a political gerrymander, I think is the term. They redefined the boundaries. They rejigged the boundaries. And then he stood again. And he got in again.
So he's got a parliamentary pension?
You can ask him that, Don.
Good.
And then he stood for the seat of Brunswick in the state parliament. In 2010, I'm not sure if he got into that. I should have known that. And he is a Republican. That is, he would not be a royalist. He'd be a Republican. And the reason I think that he's in here today is because we interviewed Nick Stevens, and he has personally suffered a family tragedy, which is well known, so he doesn't mind me saying this. He's... sister Vicky was murdered at the age of 25, and he's been a strong advocate for violence against women, which I don't know why we have to say this. We're all for that. And I think he didn't take exception, but he just was interested to know why we got Nick Stevens in, who had been charged with a similar thing and pled guilty to it. And he thought he would come in and have a chat to us about all those things we've mentioned, football, and particularly his main cause, which is violence against women. And I want to introduce Philip Ronald Cleary to you and our audience. Phil, it's great to see you, and thank you for coming in.
My pleasure, Sam. Great to meet you too, Don. We're just talking about all the old interconnections with football and blokes that I knew who played at Coburg and had started Hawthorn, Ron Beattie and Gary Halbert, and on and on it goes. But I don't have a pension. I wasn't in long enough for a parliamentary pension, so I don't want all my lefty socialist friends out there, Sam, thinking he's got a nice pension. No, I do not. I have to earn a quid my own way.
So just clear that up. So you won the seat of Wills?
Yeah. I won it in 92 at a by-election.
Yes.
Then I won it again in 93. But to win, to have a pension, you have to win three consecutive elections.
Do you? Yeah. Do you?
Yeah. Why did you stand as an independent?
Well, it was a long story, but a group of people came to see me. They were old lefties, and they said, why don't you run? I was really not that interested in running. I didn't like the idea of politics. I didn't think much of it. I'd never been into party politics. I'd never been a member of a political party. But we just got momentum, and one thing or another happened. The media took it on. Martin Flanagan wrote something in The Age, and then bingo, everyone was up for it. And it was spontaneous, Don.
But you didn't answer why did you stand as an independent?
Oh, well, I had politics. I was a political person, and as an independent, well, I wasn't in any party. So the only way I would stand was as an independent. And
do you advocate independency in government?
Well, I just think that it's good in politics if there are more people who don't have to toe the party line. I mean, Sam and I have these discussions around one thing or another, but I don't see the world as so homogenous in terms of political thinking. I don't say of someone who someone says, oh, that person's allegedly right-wing. I mightn't think that. I might think they have quite strong views. Like, I don't say, oh, someone's criticising Daniel Andrews, therefore they're no good. There's reasons to critique state government and critique COVID responses. I think we want a robust view, but the problem is lots of people are addicted to some, have got some particular interest. Some of those people have got an economic interest. And I think I didn't have one apart from whatever my politics were.
Just before we get on to, I'm interested in the football, and then we'll get on to the other reason that you might be here. Just you mentioned Daniel Andrews. Would you say, are you one of the people who think Daniel Andrews and his government are doing a good job, or are they leave a lot to be desired?
I don't know. How do you deal with what we call a pandemic? You know, how bad is it, Sam? I know some people might say, well, it's not as serious, it's a bit like the flu. I'm not sure. I haven't been really troubled by the response overall. So I think the government's handled it reasonably well. Now, to make a comparison, look at how it's done around the world. Most countries, most states have had a fairly rigorous approach to it, maybe opened up earlier than others, but I'm not that uncomfortable with it,
well, no. But what about the misinformation and the lies and the corruption and the fact that they don't tell you the truth and they make it up as they go, and his tone, his arrogance and his pompous arrogance and the way he speaks to people? I mean, honestly and truly, Phil, no one could be satisfied with that, could they?
I think you could look in at a press conference now and think it sounds patronising. And if I was giving advice, I would be saying to the Premier not to be out as much. I would cut it. I'd give it to the health officer, Brett Sutton, to do more of. I think Martin Foley, when he goes in, he sounds pretty plain speaking. So I'm not particularly troubled. If you look at the opposition, Don, you mentioned economics. Yeah, it is a problem economically.
A lot of small businesses have gone to the wall.
Small business has been atrocious, but I don't know how we would have dealt with it. Could we have just let it run rampant? And I mean, now
wouldn't you isolate, Phil, areas within Melbourne? I'm very critical that we can have state borders, but why not within the community itself? It's in the northwest and out in southeast and west. Why couldn't you put a ring around those and keep the rest of community going?
Well, that's an interesting response. And you know what? There would be leftists who would explore that question. That maybe, and it might morph into a different question as well, but I think you need greater powers at local level. Like, I think municipal councils need to have more of a role. You can't just have a big bureaucracy. which I think is the point you're kind of making in a way. It's making a broad brush approach to a question that maybe needs a little bit of particularity about it. And in a way, we're going back to community. You know, COVID's driven us back to our locality. I live in Brunswick. A lot happening there. Maybe people could respond in their communities a little differently. I see the argument. If to have a broad brush approach can be problematic.
But people are a bit sceptical, Phil, when the state government, with a handful of COVID cases, they closed the state down, and now they've opened it up with record numbers of COVID. Just political expediency because they fear the whole community is turning against them, and they're going to try and shore themselves up to get re-elected. So that's just my personal opinion.
Politics, you'd be mad to think, you know, the world is political.
Absolutely.
It'd be mad to be not thinking governments don't take account of what the punters are thinking.
Of course.
I'll give you an example. The coppers were not keen on being rolled out to have to deal with the protesters.
No.
They
right.
didn't like that. They were saying, the coppers were telling them behind the scenes, they were saying, send out the heavy artillery.
Yep.
Send out the
riot
squad.
The army?
Well, the riot squad. Send out the serious mob, because we're going out there, we're endangered, we're going to be in trouble. And those, but they were saying, what were they were saying, but for the government didn't want to roll out the riot squad because it doesn't
hang on, they did roll,
no,
didn't they roll the
correct.
Riot squad out? They fired the bullets at them.
Well, there was an argument. Yeah, I don't know. You know what exactly happened there, but the riot squad at first. But Sam, they didn't go out, did they? It was just the ordinary plot. Ordinary
That's right.
Copper.
And the premier got accused of turning the ordinary rank and file police into his own militia group.
Exactly.
And they took umbrage to that.
And they changed the strategy, did they?
They did.
Yeah.
Phil,
so
can I ask you, as an independent? The pandemic was passed by three independents in the Legislative Council. There was Medic. Fiona Patton and the lady, the Greens from out your way, I forget her name.
The rat name.
Yes. Yeah. You as an independent, and you were in that position, would you have voted for state of emergency, seeing that Andy Medic got whips, you know, horse racing whips, so that got him across the line. You know, we'll ban whips. Yeah. You know, Fiona Patton, prostitution or something, legalised on the streets, and the other girl got the fines cut by half for under 21-year-olds who can contravene the COVID laws.
Well, it's bizarre, isn't it? Sam mentioned elections. I lost the federal election with about 25%, 27% of the primary vote. Like, if you had that as a proportional representation, I'd have been back in. You know, that's a big vote not to get in. But Fiona Patton gets in on two votes. You know, it's laughable.
Yeah, it's a joke.
But she's got an amazing preference flow through to Fiona Patton that gets her in. And some people have gotten in with ridiculous preference flows. Now, we could say that's the system, but who do those people genuinely represent? I don't know. I want broader representation than that. But if I was in there having to vote, I think I would have found it difficult to know exactly how to deal with this pandemic, inverted commas, because it's new. We haven't had the experience before.
I said you stood in 2010 for the seat of...
Yeah, that was it, Brunswick. Yeah, I got about 12, 11%
And you
that
didn't
time.
Get in, you
I
said.
Didn't get in.
I see.
No.
I should have known.
But I got an 11% vote, which is, you know, that's a strong vote in that without money...
A Labor held?
Yeah, Labor stronghold in the Greens.
And you stood as an independent again.
I stood as an independent without
money. Yeah, I admire that. That's good.
Yeah, so independence, it's a tough gig as an independent, you know.
I didn't know you had to be, win three elections to get a pension.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I thought it was two.
I thought if you got in.
Well, why do you reckon people stay in the party and don't want to leave the party? You know, because as soon as they do leave the party, they do lose their seat. You know, so.
What do you think of the, we've got the IBAC, is it IBAC in Victoria?
Yeah.
What do you think, Phil, about, say, Dunellan, a minister? And he resigns from the ministry, but he's still sitting there as a parliamentarian.
Well, the punter's got every right to think it's disgraceful. The branch stacking is atrocious.
But Samoniak did the same. He was a minister, yet he's still there as an independent.
Awful people, you know. I mean...
So why doesn't a government get rolled because of that?
Well, I suppose you've got to look at the opposition and say, well...
That's it. You've got to look at the opposition.
How good are they at the moment?
That's correct. With everything that's going on with the red shirts, the coppers, the bloody cancelling the freeway, the diesel, and I mean, seriously, if you couldn't strike a blow, how bad is that going?
With all no disrespect, it's hard to be in there when you're the leader of the opposition, but Mr. O'Brien, I thought, struggled, Sam, didn't he?
Oh, did he struggle? I thought he was like a rabbit out shooting, you spotlighting, and you've got the rabbit in his eyes open up and he just stands there waiting to be shot.
Because sometimes it's better to actually say the things you agree on or agree on some of the strategies and then fine-tune them. I think people are more prepared to accept that of you. If they think you're authentic. But trying to be deliberately casting yourself as the opponent with a better strategy. I think people look in and don't want that.
Just in the entertainment industry, I was an avid listener when Triple R was in full swing back in the 70s. Yeah. And they had Punter to Punter and a lot of people came out, guns, look, beg your pardon?
I did the Coulda Beans at that time.
Just listen to me. Don't jump the gun. And there was, what's that other one, the lawyers, guns, and money.
Guns and money.
And there was the Coulda Bean champions.
Yeah.
Now, my question is, were you an original Coulda Bean champions or did you come in a little bit later?
Well, I wasn't the actual original, but I was there in 1982 doing the VFA segment with George Stone.
Yes.
You know George Stone. Yeah. And Tony Leonard. And I did that for about 10 years. Even when I was in the federal parliament, I did it. So, but they had started just prior to that, and a good friend of mine, Chris McConville, was doing the academic think tank. It was a great radio segment. And spawned some.
So they've been going since Adam was a boy, aren't they? They've now changed. Yeah, they've gone from the ABC somewhere else now.
Yeah. Well, is it AW or somewhere? I don't know.
The Coulda Beans?
Oh, no, they're still the Coulda Beans. Still got an ABC segment,
No. They've left the ABC and they're going somewhere else.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
They're following
the money, I think, maybe, now that they've become successful. Now, Phil, you are a genuine star in a competition which was very nearly as popular as the VFL in the day, the VFA, when it was the Halcyon days. There must be some unbelievable memories. I did mention that you got sent off in a grand final, unheard of in our code anyhow. This happens in soccer. And you were reprieved or found not guilty, which is a bit like shutting the door after the horse has bolted, shutting the gate. Just for that particular instance, just what happened in that grand final against Williamstown?
Can I just preface and say the VFA was a great comp. Of course, it wasn't as good as the VFL, AFL.
It was nearly as popular.
But it was exceedingly popular. And there were so many good players in Victoria at the time that the competition, the footy was fantastic. Plus VFA was 16 a side. Opened up, and your mate Fred Cook standing in the goals.
Yep.
You know, and let's face it, Fred played 30 AFL games before he was 21. He could play.
Yep.
You know, Ron Beattie came to us from Don's team. He'd played a dozen games before he was 21. So these blokes could play. But
Rex Hunt went down there and
went to Sandringham in 1980 or 81.
Yep.
And he played and he kicked a few goals. And
a lot of goals.
It was. Peter McKenna went to Port Melbourne in 79 and captain coached Port Melbourne.
Have I made this up or not? Did Ron Barassi play?
Here in the 60s. Ron
Bob, and Bob Skilton played in the state.
Bob Skilton both went to Port Melbourne.
Port Melbourne.
Unbelievable. But 86. Now, by 86, I was going on 34. I was past my best football. I was still super fit. I trained really hard and I was pretty strong. And I still had a bit of speed over 15, 10, 20 metres. I could hit pretty hard. Anyway, there was a skirmish on the grandstand side of the Junction Oval. We were 3 points down to Willie, who was coached by Terry Wheeler.
Yep.
Everyone knows Footscray man. And I think the AFL Coach of the Year in 92. Didn't he take him to a prelim, I think, the Doggies? Anyway, I had a little skirmish with a bloke called Tony Pastore. Now, Tony went on to play in the AFL, had a couple of games, I think, maybe with Richmond. Anyway, umpire Jeff Ryan, for some reason, reported me.
For some reason, Phil. Well, maybe because your belt belted Mr. Pastorelli.
No, I actually, Sam, I tell you what happened. I bumped him, but he said as we grappled, he reported me for kneeing him to the groin, kneeing him to the testicles.
Yes.
Well, I can tell you, it didn't happen. It did not happen.
Yep.
Did not happen. We were in a scrimmage, a scuffle, and I think he panicked, umpire Jeff Ryan. Bang, and in those days it was automatic off. I went off for 15 minutes and Williamstown just went berserk. And they kicked, like, we trailed by 9 goals within the 16 minutes. And I'm not saying people go, oh, Phil, the champion plate. No, it was the psychological impact. Yep. It just had a momentum shift and they all went, you know, ballistic, Williamstown. Everything they touched turned to gold. We ended up only losing by 13 points after being 9 goals down.
Wow.
And we would have won the premiership.
Yep.
And I go to the tribunal and the chairman, you know, he looks at the video and he goes, can't see anything there. Bad decision. No, that's not guilty. Off you go.
Yeah, now, honestly, did Mr. Pescatore, what's his name?
Pastore.
Did he gild the lily? Did he go down holding his groin and...
No, actually, Pastore was the first one. I bumped him. He'd been playing really well, and Don, you'd understand this, a bit of gamesmanship. He was dominating, and I thought I'd just tease him, rough him up a little bit. But it backfired because then I went to a bloke called Sleverson and I was reported for kneeing Sleverson, not Pastore. And Rick Sleverson knows, he would know. It just, there was no knee to the balls. It just wasn't.
So was there an order off rule back then?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
Of course there was, Don. That's why he got ordered off.
Yeah, oh, I couldn't.
But it was automatic, Don, in that once you got the unduly rough play... I think every report was off, but he gave me unduly rough play. And when I said to the umpire, what for? He said, unduly rough play. And I just went, oh, and went away thinking, unduly rough play. So, but I didn't realise he was going to pinch me for kneeing to the ball. If he'd said you kneed him to the testicles, I would have gone ballistic because I knew that didn't happen. Yep. I thought he was getting me for rough play. But one little twist, who do you reckon was calling the order off? No. Eddie Maguire.
Oh, no.
You
really?
Wouldn't believe it. Phil Cleary, he's been ordered off.
Well, and who is he doing that for?
Channel 10.
And it's on YouTube, so all your listeners can go to YouTube and spot it with Eddie calling it.
So Phil Gibbs started the VFA on Channel... Was it Channel O then? Or
yes,
was it still
Channel O.
Channel O then.
With Ted Henry. Ted Henry.
67, they started it. Amazing. And your mate, Eddie Mealy.
Eddie Mealy. I played with him at Geelong.
50-odd games in the reserves he played, didn't he?
He did.
And I was just thinking, you would have known, Don, you came across... And there he go. He played a couple of games at South Melbourne.
Yeah,
and off Mealy. He goes to Dandy, probably a big wad of money.
Yep.
And he plays, and he's a legendary figure.
He is a legendary figure.
And I was laughing to Sam about this. We're playing Dandenong at Coburg, 1976 TV game. Big game. They go on to play in the grand final to lose to Port in a violent grand final. But we're playing them. And at three-quarter time, Big Eddie waltzes past me. You little effing wog.
Yeah.
He goes, and I thought, that's funny. Yes. I was thinking, isn't he a Dutchman?
I was going to say, yeah.
A Dutchman with an Italian name, that's I reckon, right. Mealy, too.
Now,
I
tell me about a bloke that
go
you...
Go on, hang on. Don, Jesus Christ,
as
man.
As he goes, I go, we'll see about that. Well, you wouldn't believe it. It's a TV game. I've kicked 3 to 3-quarter time, and bingo, Don... 3, 4, 5, 6. How am I going now, Eddie?
Yeah.
7, bang.
You kicked 7.
I kicked 7.
Wow.
And Big Eddie, he had the big sort of half grin, you know, because he was that sort of fella. But that was Eddie, and we lost him, didn't we? And he was a shirt salesman or something. What did he say?
Yeah, when I came from school in 1963, played in the reserves grand final, Eddie Mealy was... there, and he used to come to training. He had a white MG sports car, and how he fitted into it, God only knows, but he was a bon vivant, man. He was a legend.
And he was born in 41, I think,
yep.
Which he'd be 80 now.
Yep.
I think in the Netherlands it says, well, they were occupied by the Nazis when he was born.
Yep.
I've never got to talk to him, and I was thinking the other day, I'd love someone to tell us, someone out there who knows his story, tell us where he came from in Holland. Netherlands. Well, what was he doing? What was his family doing? When did they come to Australia?
Well, I would like to know about one player you played against. He fixed up a player that I played with at Hawthorn called Stuart Trott, who was coach of Caulfield at the time. And his name, what are you putting your hands to your face? Because his name was Price.
Trevor Price.
Yeah.
Well, what did you put your hands to your face for?
Trevor was a very interesting character. Trevor, by day, worked carrying soft drink cartons around. What was that company out there in the
Tarek's? Lloyd's?
Lloyd's. One of those.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's Schweppes or something. Cotties.
He was a big man. Well, he stood about 6'2", 1.5", 6'1", but massive shoulders. And because he did all this labouring work, you know, today it's gymnasiums, but in the old days, Sam and Scott Donnie, you'd have seen your
manual labour.
Doing labouring work. Even they were all over the place. But he was big and strong. But he was involved in a couple of incidents, and people are going to have views on it. And I think the Stuart Trott one was, I didn't see it. I did not see it. I was actually out injured that day, and I watched the game, but I didn't see the incident. But you know, and he also was in.
He broke his jaw, basically. Well, put him right out of business. Him,
I know, and I think he claims, or it was claimed, that Stuart Trott had a go at him, but I'm not going to defend any of that sort of stuff. There were things in the old game, notwithstanding the fact that Trevor Price was courageous and tough. There's no question about that. He was tough. He'd put his head down and go for the ball. But, you know, you blokes saw things. When you think of the old game, some shocking things happened.
Shocking.
I mean... Yep.
So there were more that there was more than one Stuart Trott that Pricey fixed up.
Well, he had a skirmish with John Scarlett.
Yep.
Teammate of yours.
Yep.
In the 1979 Grand Final, we're at the Junction Oval, 20,000 people and a massive TV audience. And who do you reckon? Geelong West are coached by?
Billy Goggin.
Billy Goggin. Yep. And you've got John Scarlett playing.
A great side in those days, weren't they?
Oh, gee, was a Brown, Radojevic.
Yep.
John Friend played. Ivan Russell. Did he have a few reserves games there?
Yes.
Gee, there were Dizzy Lynch played at some point in that thing. And anyway, they wrestled on the ground and John Scarlett got up and he was bleeding profusely and he had a torn tear duct. So, you know, I think Trevor would claim that it was accidental, but, you know, I'm not here to defend.
Did he play many games?
Trevor played in three premiership. He played in two second divisions and our 79 premiership and played a lot of football. He was a very good footballer, star player.
So, Phil, while the VFL that Don and I played in before it came the AFL, it was pretty tough, but it was brutal in the VFA because it wasn't as well scrutinised by there were some pretty ordinary things that happened and have been weeded out in the main game, the AFL now, probably, although they've tended to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but they had to clean that up or people would have been investigating a homicide before long on the VFA grounds.
Well, you two blokes played in that top end and, you know, you played massive. What did you play, over 300, Don, didn't you? And you were regarded as a tough player. Mm. But you weren't you wouldn't have whacked. Did you ever make the mistake of hitting someone?
Oh, you'd be joking,
ever whack,
wouldn't you?
Anyone?
Oh, Phil, please.
Listen, Phil, what am I? I don't know.
Me primarily.
I don't know if you can remember I remember the Halcyon days because I used to go and watch it on a Sunday. It was an institution and it was promoted by Channel 10 every Sunday. But from that, the overflow was that if the game wasn't telecast, there were huge crowds at the various games. I went out to Preston to watch Preston play someone. I'll go to Paran and watch Paran play. And it wasn't the televised game. It wasn't the main game. But there were huge crowds at these Sunday afternoon games.
You'd understand this, I think. You played at Glenferrie Oval. Didn't you? You had a few games.
We played at Glenferrie,
But, I mean, when you think, that was distinctive, wasn't it? This little ground with that funny grandstand stuck away there with the railway line alongside it and people looking to go, isn't that magic? And that VFA, we had magical grounds. We had Port Melbourne. We had Preston.
Brunswick.
We had Brunswick. Mm. We had all these magical grounds. Coburg. Sam will come to Brunswick. Yeah. Talking the fisticuffs. I played against a bloke called Barry Nolan. We buried
from Brunswick. Buried
recently, from Brunswick. Won the Liston Trophy. Barry was a great boxer. And in front of the grandstand in, well, I was about 1978 or 9, I reckon, and he won the Liston. I'm not sure if it was the same year, but so we're having a discussion about this. But I flicked him at a boundary throw-in, threw my hand back and clipped him. Mm. Well, as I turned, he just went bang, bang, and he hit me with a beautiful left-right combination, I believe, because I didn't quite see it, sat me on my ass, and he got reported. And I laugh when I tell the story. Every single umpire reported him, went to the tribunal, put a medal around his neck and said, you can go home. For services to football, we're decorating you today, Barry. You're knocking Cleary over. Anyway, he got off, but we...
He got off.
Didn't even get pinched. And I went to his birthday, 70th birthday a couple of years back, and he was suffering from Parkinson's. And I celebrated him because I thought, all right, he did whack me, but he was a beautiful human being. And he said to me, he whispered in my ear, he said, yeah, it wasn't very good what I did. I'm not proud of it, Phil.
Now, listen, there was an umpire. There was an umpire that used to intrigue me.
Yeah,
and
I know.
He used to wear tight shorts and a tight...
Is that Mr. Vagona?
Yeah.
This little bastard used to run around with these tight shorts on and tight thing.
Yeah, that's him.
Is that him?
Oh, Frankie Vagona, he was legendary. Those pants right up his ass with the oil on it. Yeah, he used to laugh about. We'd say it, we'd tell jokes about him. He'd be lying in bed. He'd have a mirror on the ceiling of his bedroom so he could look at himself. He pinched me in 1983 at Coburg. We were playing the round 16. We had to win the next two to make the finals. I kicked a goal to put us in front. But earlier on, I'd collected a bloke called Peter Wilkinson, who came from
a good player.
Yeah, very good
player. Played at Port Melbourne.
Yes, very good player. And Peter had a dip at me, and I'd collected him in an incident. And, of course, Sam, I handballed over his head. Yeah. And as I handballed, I saw his arm coming towards me, and he used to wear a lot of tape. Well, I got in first. I put my arm up, and lo and behold, of course, I collected him, and down he went like a bag of chaff. Anyway, Groom and Vagona get to the tribunal, Don. They absolutely crucified me. They said he had the ball, and funny, they said he had the ball, he handballed, and Cleary ran straight at him, a fierce, ferocious bang. And we said, gee, they're telling a fib. Let's show the video. So we showed the video. Of course, the video wasn't highly complimentary about what I'd done, but we thought it'd expose the fact they weren't telling the truth, Sam. Well, the chairman goes, yes, proves one thing. You hit him, it was forceful, and he was hurt. 4 weeks.
fantastic.
How come he umpired grand finals? Was he a good umpire?
He was. Well, I tell you what, Don, he was one of those umpires who you could have an exchange of words with.
Oh, yeah.
You could say to him, Jesus, that was a shit decision, thank you. Yeah. And he'd go, no, Phil, it was exactly right. Rule 35B, you know. And you'd go, you're good on you, Frank. He taught Latin at a private school. So, yes, we all said he loved Port Melbourne, though. We said he would give Port everything. And in the 1980 grand finals, I say to you, Frankie, if you're listening, you did give him the world.
Now, Phil, I've just been listening to this with interest. You belted a lot of people, mate. You were seemed to be the game's anti-hero, except for the side you played for. Were you a persona? Yeah, you were a persona non grata with most of the people you played against, which is probably to your credit.
Well, yeah,
probably
I didn't ever king hit anyone, Sam.
No.
I never whacked anyone with a fist.
But you gave receipts out?
I look, in those days you could shirt front. When you wind the clock back, you look at it and think, geez, it was dangerous. If people go to YouTube, they'll see me shirt fronting Peter Wilkinson at the Junction Oval in the 1982 prelim final. And fair dinkum, I have hit him with the kitchen sink, and I'm off from the ground as I turn. boy, and I look back and I admit, if I today I would say that's terrible, you can't allow that. And we're talking concussion today too, you know. So now, so I was hard at it, I think, Sam. People said I was good. Courageous. No, I'm glad.
No, I know. You know Fred Cook's a great friend of mine. I used to go along to the games and watch him play, and no, he spoke very highly of you. He said you're a very tough man. There's a double-barreled question here. Your captain coached Coburg from 84 to 87, and then you coached them to back-to-back premiers, coached them in 88, 89. Tough gig to captain coach. And were you ever approached, because you were, had a very good CV, were you ever thought of going into the VFL and being approached by any VFL clubs to coach?
Well, that's interesting, Sam. I did. Just going back, in 1977, I played two practice games with Carlton, 77. And I kicked three goals in the first half of one against Alan Mangles, who went to Geelong, I think, in 1980. And I was in the shower. And lo and behold, I'm in the shower in that old grandstand on the northern end with Bruce Doole and Robert Walls. Robert Walls had grown up in the northern suburbs. Yeah. He'd started. So I'm there, and Bruce Doole says, "Gee, you're going well, Phil." He said, "You're damn bloody tough." He said, "You're a chance for sure." And I went, "Oh, thanks, Bruce." And then Robert Walls chums in, "Yeah, the story is, Phil, you'll be playing. They reckon they're going to play you on the centre in the big scratch match against Fitzroy. You're going to play on Gary Wilson."
Now,
he was a Brownlow medal.
No, he didn't win a Brownlow, but he... Whew.
Didn't he?
No, Gary Wilson never won a Brownlow.
Oh, sorry,
Don. So he was Fitzroy, though.
Yeah, Fitzroy. Yeah.
So I'm thinking, hey, Sam, so I think, I'm going to be playing in the middle against this champion player in a week's time. Anyway, I got a phone call, I think, during the week. I was teaching at Sunshine West Secondary College. I got a phone call.
You were teaching history?
Yeah, history and politics. And I get a phone call from a bloke who says, "Look, Phil, we've decided we're going to let you go. We've recruited Peter Bedford, and we want to sell you to Essendon." And I went, "Jesus Christ." So I went back to Coburg I had a really good year. But Peter Bedford, and lo and behold, Peter Bedford, I played against him two years later, Brownlow medalist. But he was done by the time he went to Carlton. But he played for Port Melbourne 2 years later, and I'm playing against him.
Fantastic.
So all these interconnections. But the coaching, it's interesting because Vicky was murdered in August 1987, and we had to go to a grand final the next year. And I had a text from a bloke one time, Ken Ingram, who played. And he reminded
Ken Ingram from Coburg coached Sorrento.
Did he?
Yes.
Yes, he went. That's right. He went around. He was a bloody good player, Ken. I think he could have been an AFL player. Anyway, Ken said, "You know, Phil, what you did in coaching us at that time, given what your family and you'd been through, was quite remarkable." In my words, kind of. That was the meaning. And yeah, so when I think back, captain coach was very tough gig, you know. And I think I could have done better as a non-playing coach. But 88. It's a year after Vicky's murder, and we win the premiership. And in that grand final, Bob Hawke was about 10 metres from my left. He came into the rooms. He was the federal member for Wills. And I spoke before the game. I said to the players...
Was he Prime Minister then?
Yes, he was, Don. And he was the number one ticket holder at Coburg. And our president was Alan Tripp, the betting man.
Yes, the great Alan Tripp.
Vanuatu Bookshop, the wealthiest man in the world, sort of. You know, we'd done all the bookmaker stuff. We'd had all the gangsters wandering through Coburg, the Morans, Alphonse Gangitano, because, you know, SP Bookmakers drew them. So Alan knew them all. Anyway, we get to 88, and Bob Hawke's only 5 metres from me, and I say to the players something like, "This is a big day. If we win, it will bring some joy to my family, given what we've lost." So I said, "I hope we can." I said, "But, you know, in the end, it's a game of football. It's a premiership. We want to win that, but the pressure isn't on you to do that for us. But if it happens, it'll be very good for my family." Well, bingo. We played beautiful football. We beat Williamstown, and then we did it again the next year. And that occurred, so Vicky 87, Premiership 88, Premiership 89. And when I look back, as I say to people, I think you and I had this brief discussion, Sam, in a way that was important in my life. It kept me, you know, alive, thinking, and it brought joy to my family. But it was a beautiful time.
So, Phil, the reason... we probably are here doing this today is that we don't regularly have phone calls, but I enjoy them every time we do have one. You are just intrigued as to why we interviewed Nick Stevens, and you had some comments about that, and I think you've since spoken to Nick Stevens. You're a bit bemused by it. I had a feeling you thought we were giving him some comfort or succor to the fact, and nothing could be further from the truth. But I know about Vicky, and you're a great advocate for all that, and I don't know why anyone we have to keep saying we're all advocates for that. Were you disappointed we interviewed Stevens?
What would you say about that? It was a throwaway line to...
No, that's all right.
Mine was a throwaway line to Jackie Epstein.
Yeah.
I actually asked it the other. Was it Epstein or Epstein?
Epstein.
Jackie Epstein. It was a throwaway line, just a laugh, you know. Look, I think we should talk to men about these matters, but I just set one kind of guideline. I think men should acknowledge that they can say sorry. Like, we've all lived the footy culture and we've heard stories. It's not a weakness to actually say, look, I know a bloke who did something. I didn't tell him he shouldn't have been talking like that about women. He told a story about hitting his wife. I didn't tell him off for it. But now I've changed my mind. I think it's right. We've got to be critical of each other about the question. So, and I heard that you got Nick on and you grilled him and you said some strong things to him. What's complicated about Nick's story is he's now saying, whilst he pleaded guilty, he wasn't guilty. And so I said to him, look, Nick, I said, if you say that, where can I take it? If you said to me you did it and you're sorry, I would have said, without being saintly about it or as if I'm pontificating, I'd have said, good on you. Just go out and say, I'm really sorry. Let's move on. And for all men, realise that it's not a good look. And it reflects badly on all of us. So
it's a very good point. Because we did say that. Don said congratulations coming in. Well, I don't think congratulations. Yeah. We appreciate him coming in, and we said, mate, you cannot plead guilty to doing something like that and expect people to cut you some slack. If you weren't guilty, just say you're not guilty. And if and to your point, if you are, we'll just cop it. And so it's got to the stage now, and this is a contentious thing to talk about, because it sounds like you're having a bet each way, but I'm not. But it used to mean no means no when you go out with a woman and you're going to try and have sex with her, but now you actually almost have to get it in writing that yes means yes. It's the dynamic has changed so much now that it's a minefield, and this has nothing to do with Nick Stevens. No. This is just about female, male, any relationships, doesn't matter if they're female, male, just means just relationships. Now it's such a minefield where it could end up and what the ulterior motive are for both parties.
Yeah, I don't know whether it is that complex, and I'll answer your question this way. In the old days, it might have been understood, or men came to learn, that if they were trying to seduce a woman, sometimes a woman might have said no and they could, or might be reluctant and they think they could entice a woman.
Yes.
I don't think that has changed so much. If a woman said no at first, but then, I don't mean, just be clear about this, but then at some point that changed, then the circumstances have changed. But what I think women are saying to us clearly is, there's a point where once they have said no, the bloke knows a no. The bloke, I think every bloke knows what no means. I don't think I've been in a situation where I haven't understood no. I can't think of, I just can't think of that I didn't get it. I was confused. So I think it's pretty clear that no, I think blokes know when no means no.
Absolutely, Phil. But then, and this is just by no means a cop out, but then, of course, you have the influence of alcohol and drugs.
From I don't both think that's an excuse.
No, of course it's not an excuse.
I know where you're going, though, but I follow
then,
you.
Yeah. And then, so the mind just tends to be ceases to be logical about it. And this is not from the man's point of view. In any relationship, whether it be same-sex relationships or whatever, it is a minefield out there.
And I'd say this too. I use the term, and campaigners use the term, infantilizing, which means you don't turn a woman into a childlike creature. You can't be suddenly saying to a woman, oh, you can't, you shouldn't be drinking because drinking might lead to sex. I mean, what are women going to say to us if we start dictating to them? Yeah. A woman can have alcohol and have sex, a man and a woman could have a drink. It's just that the bloke's got to be conscious that the woman is consenting. I mean, you know, we've heard stories about women in bed, intoxicated, and some bloke having sex with her.
Oh, we've just heard this in politics just recently. Yes. And what's going on up I keep saying women, but this is any relationship. The alcohol tends to make people more loosen up and relaxed, and then suddenly they regret whoever it is that it happened, and they file a complaint, and then the old hell breaks loose.
But I suppose if you go to what we call empirical evidence, historically, women have not been big on making allegations of rape. It's not massive. If you look at the history of rape, research it, and I've researched this through researching violence against women, the number of times where men have gotten away with it, and when it's gone to court, women have been pilloried in courtrooms. I've read cases going back in time. They're appalling, you know, the way women are treated. So if I just try to understand your point, Sam,
I'm not really trying to make a point. I'm just saying
it's
complicated.
Yes, it is. It is. But I don't know that women... Are women running to the police to say, oh, I had sex with a bloke, it was rape? I don't think that's really happening. I mean, most times when women say it's rape, people, good, considered people looking in, believe that it is. When a woman says she's been, it's non-consensual, they believe she's telling the truth.
No, fair enough. Absolutely fair enough. Now, you took exception, Phil, to, this is well documented, so it's public knowledge, that you took exception to the fact that Peter Keogh, the person who murdered your sister, had a manufactured defence by his solicitor, Dyson Hall Lacey.
Oh, no, different story.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
No, but
I'm
you're
sorry.
On the money. You mean the Ramage case? I got sued for defamation. That was the Ramage case.
I am so sorry.
Yeah, but that's okay.
That's correct. And then you said that I remember that now.
Yeah.
He manufactured the evidence to get a lesser sentence. Yeah. See, Nick Stevens said that he pled guilty because they told him that instead of getting 8 months prison, he'd get 2 months or something. So I said...
18 charges he had, and they dropped them back to 2 charges.
And we did say, mate, once you plead guilty, I said, no one listens after that, I don't think. Anyhow, so so the law was used, you believe, was manifest, and you got charged with defamation, which you lost. That must have really...
Yeah, there are two elements here,
stuck
Sam.
In your throat.
Yeah, stuck in the craw. The Keogh case was 1989. Keogh was able to plead provocation. The judge allowed him a provocation defence, and he was found not guilty of murder and sentenced to 3 years, 11 months in jail. I mean, I've written extensively about that.
Seems extraordinary.
Yeah, my argument was clear. Vicky was parking her car for work on the 26th of August 1987 at 8 a.m, and Keogh accosted her. He was armed. He was a bastard. He's a misogynist. What he did was such an act of murder, you could not have given him a provocation defence, even if you believe that provocation can exist as a concept. So that was the Keogh case. When it came to Ramage, he was the millionaire businessman who strangled his wife in Baldwin. But you're so on the money.
Yep.
And I wrote in a book called Getting Away with Murder, I wrote about that, about a manufacturing of a provocation defence. Dyson Hall Lacey did sue, and how ironic, you know, I'd sat in Dyson Hall Lacey's chambers when Fitzroy were in trouble, you know.
Yes,
and
that's
I think in the federal parliament, and I offered Fitzroy to come to Coburg. They came to Coburg and train. I actually spoke about Fitzroy in the federal parliament yep. defending them, yep. saying, we need this club. So Dyson sued. I understand Dyson was saying that I was writing that he manufactured the defence for Keogh, for Ramage, the millionaire business, as you call it. And I say to Dyson, and I said it many times, I wasn't saying that Dyson manufactured the defence for Ramage. Ramage manufactured his own defence. Once he was told, if I'm a lawyer and I say, well, James Ramage, there is a defence called provocation, and it's this. Once I'm told that and I'm Ramage, I go, right.
That's me.
Ramage tells a story, and the elements are Ramage then said his wife belittled him sexually. So to all the men out there, you know, blokes, you're in our age, who know about women, know about life, and we've got to say to them. So a woman says, you shit house in bed, the other bloke was better, you got a little dick, you're no fucking good at sex. Do we all then go, oh, Jesus, so we'll go and strangle her and kill her? But he ran that argument. He said that's what she said. I don't believe she would have. I reckon she'd have been too scared to be going that hard. She might have said, I've got a new man in my life and I prefer him to you, he's better than you, yep. and Ramage just killed her. So, but that's what he got to argue, that provocation was. And, you know, as blokes, we know men and women, a woman could give you a bit of lip.
So it was.
We should be able to cop lip, shouldn't we, off a woman?
It was, absolutely. Well, haven't we? Gee, I could write a book on it. So you got a judgment against you for $650.
Yeah, the publisher, Allen and Unwin, paid, thankfully, because if I'd had.
I was going to say, that's what I was going to ask you. I know. So anyhow,
are you a spokesman, Phil, or an advocate? I'm confused.
Just, look, I'm just a campaigner. I don't have a.
Have you achieved anything as a campaigner?
Well, you know what, Don? One of the most significant things is that we are sitting here today discussing the question. And even if Sam and I don't see eye to eye on it. And
we see eye to eye on this. Phil, please don't.
Yeah, no, sorry. I don't want to misrepresent you, Sam, and I didn't mean it like that, yep. so I apologise for that. What I meant was, if we didn't see eye to eye on some element of the discussion about what qualifies as disrespect or putting women down, we could not agree on. So say I went to Caroline Wilson, you and I might not agree on some portion there.
Yes.
Say I didn't agree. But the thing is, we're having a broad discussion about the question, and I don't for a minute want to be putting you in the category of the person supporting or giving comfort to the wife bashers. I'm not saying that at all, Sam. You're strong.
Thank
about
you,
it.
Phil.
So what I'm saying is, to come back to you, Don, to have the discussion amongst men is so important. I go out to clubs. I'll go to sporting clubs. I talk to men. Paul Kennedy from the ABC had me go down to his footy club. Down at
Seaford,
yes. I went down and spoke to the boys. We need to be saying to men, look, equal relationships, you want to respect, men and women have got to live on equal terms. You can't be part of this underbelly of men that won't accept women having their own
interests. So you're a spokesman?
Yeah, in my own, no, I'm not paid by somebody. I haven't got a government gig or a gig anywhere. I'll go and speak and people will pay me to speak, but I don't do many of them. And COVID, I haven't been able to speak, you know. But I do some the odd Zoom. But, yeah, I do it in my – it's my own life cause.
Don, fascinating man.
Yeah, my word.
This is the old Dorothy Dix. The most impressive people you played with or against in the VFA that captured your imagination for some reason, whatever that be, toughness, strength, ability – prowess. Who were some of the names that people listening to this would love to reflect on?
Well, it was hard not to love Fred Cook. With all his foibles, I remember up at the Coburg Footy Ground one day, Sam, he wandered into the rooms after a game. It might have been 1976 when he kicked about 8 or 9. And in that year, the first game of the year, we thrashed Port Melbourne and Ron Beattie played on Cook and held him goalless. And Fred says, no one keeps me goalless twice in a year. Anyway, we went out to Coburg. It's a northerly breeze blowing down to the grandstand end. Fred's got four or five in the first quarter, Sam, yeah, with the northerly. Yeah. And Ron's got shifted after he's got about six. And I remember it might have been this day. He wanders through the club rooms upstairs, the old mezzanine, and he was like a rock star.
He was.
He's tall, beautiful brown hair, great look, big face. And an interesting swagger. And I thought, he was beautiful to watch and to see in life. And a couple of games where he just played to the crowd.
He did.
He was great. I loved Barry Nolan. And when he was buried recently, I made the point of the old story. Scholars might remember it, and kids in Catholic schools. Horatio at the Bridge was a little a Roman Italian story, and I read it in Latin at school. Horatio held the bridge, you know, against one of the tribes, and that was Barry Nolan to me. You know, he played down back. He was about 6'1". He was lean, but he would go and take the best player. So if there was a gun forward, Barry would go as captain coach of Brunswick. I'll go down and play on him. And Barry took him to premierships. So they were two of the standouts. I loved Paddy Flaherty.
Yes, I remember the name.
Dandy half forward.
Beautiful left foot glide. And we played a game one day at Dandy and it was wet. And he kicked a torpedo punt on a wet ground that went 55 metres. But the other one, through the goals, the other one was Frosty Miller.
Miller.
How could you
wow.
not love Frosty? He goes to Carlton in the early 60s. Barassi's the coach. Barassi hasn't got much time for this sort of kid who's from the country, and Frosty's not a great talker. And, you know, in those days, Garfield. Yeah. People thought that Garfield, like, was deliverance territory.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right.
And evidently, Frosty was driving his motorbike one time and he hit a cow when he was a Carlton. Put him out of contention, but he went on and kicked five goals against Ted Potter.
Yes, Ted Potter, ex Collingwood.
Park.
Yep.
And so he goes on in the VFA. He'd have played a lot of AFL footy. So they were three, probably two of the champion forwards. Paddy Flaherty, a goal kicker, and Barry Nolan down back.
Fantastic.
What did you take out of Parliament then?
Well. Lots of people who probably wanted to do good things. I was lucky enough to be there with Paul Keating as Prime Minister. So I got to see Keating with all his accoutrements, with all his glamour, with all his class, with all his language, and he was glorious to watch. He could just not, you know, take the mickey out of people. And I was there for the Mabo legislation, you know, Indigenous rights land question. So what did I take out of it? Funnily enough,
he collected clocks, Paul Keating, didn't he?
Antiques.
He was an avid clock collector.
And he wore Xenia suits, and the Liberals used to have a lark with him and condemn him. You know, they'd say, oh, the left-wing Paul Keating socialist type. You know, look at him in his Xenia suits. He wore these beautiful suits.
Yeah.
He was a very elegant man, you know, a bit fragile, but he moved rather gracefully through the parliament, and he spoke so well. He could incisive. He could destroy what he called the Tories. But out of parliament, it was funny. Because when you're a federal politician, you get a little bit of status. And so I was able, because of Parliament, to travel. We went on a couple of delegations, and I know you call them junkets, but I went to India and we met the president some of the top politicians in India. And
Prime Minister, isn't he? Isn't the Indian...
Yeah, they have a... they had a president and a prime minister.
Oh, did they? Sorry.
But there was a bloke called Singh who was also the finance minister in the 90s. And he was a really significant character. And I've followed him a little bit in recent times. But so met some significant people. But I got to meet Gerry Adams.
Oh, yes. Really?
In Ireland. Yep. So... Because I'm the federal member of parliament of Irish extraction, my people originally came from Limerick 150, 60 years ago, and I'm in the parliament. I put in a request. I know some Republicans, and they get me an invite, a meeting with Adams. 1994 on the Falls Road in the middle of West Belfast, and I go upstairs into the room, and it's all bombarded. Mm. Well, it's been bombarded, yep, but it's all locked up. It's like a fortress. And there's a big sign, a plaque on the wall. It says, Sinn Féin shrugs off missile attack. and the window had been bricked up, and I said to one of them, what's that about? I said, the loyalists fired a missile at the building. And I'm in there. Anyway, last bit of the story is the British troops are outside knocking on the door because they want to know, yep, who owns the car around the corner or something. I think it might have been mine. Anyway, the Republicans just said, none of your business, fuck off. Fuck off. And I thought, Jesus Christ, this soldiers with big AK-47s or whatever they are, and these Republican blokes.
The IRA.
Yep.
So Gerry Adams was the leader.
Sinn Féin president. So you wouldn't say the IRA was the military wing.
Yep.
The blokes in the room with him are his own Sinn Féin people.
But they're the political people. Sinn Féin's the political arm of the IRA.
But they're not frightened of this military mob,
yep,
outside.
Yep.
Wow, and I thought, gee, that's courage.
Did you achieve anything in Parliament?
I think, yeah, good point, Don. And I've been asked this before. Legislation, no, but I think I changed. Not just me, but Ted Mack in New South Wales.
Yeah.
Major, first independent before me. I think we changed the landscape.
In what way?
Well, these days you don't talk like independents can't be in the Parliament. When I got elected, everyone was saying you can't elect an independent, it's a wasted vote. Now, 20-odd years, 30 years later, everyone accepts that an independent can be in the Parliament. Can elect independents, notwithstanding the problems of someone getting in with three votes with a preference flow. But I think that's changed the landscape. And I think even today, I would love to see a Parliament, state parliament, I'd love to see 10 independents in there. And this discussion about COVID would be a much more healthy conversation.
So Hinch got in on a platform on pedophilia, basically, yes, or naming
yeah, all, yes,
people. I think he went to jail for contempt of court.
Exactly.
What about teaching? You're a teacher.
You might have paved the way for people like that.
I think so.
Profiled people.
Yeah, without blowing up my own tyres, I think people are now more prepared for it. And I think when they voted me in, it was because they were tired of the two-party system. And if you look around, everyone is. We're all a bit tired of it. Doesn't mean you can't have two major parties, but you need other voices. I mean, I want to hear other people give a take on these questions. And the problem is, at the moment, and I'll come to that teacher, the problem is you get... So Daniel Andrews and the Labor Party giving you a particular view, and then the opposition is just giving you a trashy attempt to be relevant approach rather than a more sophisticated approach to it. And the sophisticated approach would come from a parliament that was more diverse.
Okay, Don?
Just teaching. I was talking to a teacher and we're discussing it. I've got a view on it. What is your view on teaching at the moment? Is the balance right with regard to male and female teachers?
you think in the primary sector because not enough men.
And secondary too.
Yeah. Look, I think you want a mixed group of teachers. It's interesting. When I started teaching in 1976 out at Sunshine West, 1,300 kids, 13 portables, 80 staff, a real mix of men and women, and I think that taught me a lot too, because I'm there teaching with women who are bright and intelligent and educated and got great ideas. I think we need that diversity, and it's probably a school that's got more diversity in terms of the makeup of men and women is probably going to be better for you. You thinking, they're thinking that, or are they saying men are not doing it because of?
Well, there doesn't seem to be the attraction. Men don't seem to be going into that profession, whereas once, especially when I was younger, there was an equal balance of men and women.
I haven't actually been speaking to people about what's happening in the secondary colleges.
Talking about primary as well.
Yeah, primary is definitely an issue, they say. Now, I mean, some people all talk conspiratorially and say it's about, political correctness making it harder for men. I think some people say that, but I don't really know for sure. But I did love teaching. I had great times teaching. Yeah, I used to enjoy teaching history, and one of the things I used to do a lot was wander out to old cemeteries. I used to go up to Dalesford and wander through old cemeteries, and kids used to love that.
Well, now,
and football too was a great history teacher.
Philip, Simon, Cleary, it's been fantastic to speak to you. We speak reasonably often, not reasonably often, we speak every now and again on the phone, and you're an intelligent man who engages in any dispute and with absolute respect, and I enjoy your company, and as I say, there'd be very few things we agree on in life, but discussions and communication is one of them, and so we appreciate you coming in.
Well, you know, see, I like strident, independent people. I just say the only challenge for us is to at least make sure we're working off fact as best we can. Get our facts lined up. But are we finished?
That's you. You finished it.
I'm moping around the streets late at night. I'm worried because you ain't treating me right. Come back again.